Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Smithsonian Magazine program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. I'll be reading from the April-May 2024 issue of the Smithsonian Magazine today. I hope you enjoy the program. We're going to begin with this article titled, Las Vegas Bets on the Future. As the Southwest dries, can a city, notorious for excess, find a way to survive with less and less water? It's by Daniel Rothberg. Anything goes in Las Vegas, except excessive water use. 2 decades ago, the city began to grapple with a reality that many other cities in the Southwest were trying to put off. Eventually, it could run out of water. In contrast with cities like Phoenix or Los Angeles, which get water from a number of sources, Las Vegas still gets about 90% of its water from the Colorado River, and it has little other water to tap into. By the time the river hit a record low in 2002, Las Vegas had begun taking aggressive water-saving measures to meet population growth and adapt to a drying river. The city, known for excess and summer pool parties, began counting every drop, even the small dribbles flowing onto asphalt. "We couldn't have made additional water commitments," says John Ensminger, the Southern Nevada Water Authority's general manager. "No more homes, no more casinos, no population growth at all." Today, signs of growth in Las Vegas are unavoidable. Traffic, new buildings, a push to open up federal public land for private development. At a dinner in downtown Las Vegas, where construction cranes mark the sky, State Assemblyman Howard Watts III, who has sponsored a slate of recent Las Vegas conservation bills, says growth is something the city continues to grapple with. And a lot comes down to how water is managed. "What's the water bottom line going to be," he asks, "and how do you make that math work?" The restrictions in place in Las Vegas include limiting pool sizes, forbidding cooling systems that pass air over evaporated water, also known as swamp coolers, in new buildings, issuing fines when water leaks onto sidewalks, restricting personal car washing to once a week, and prohibiting homes from having fountains or decorative ponds larger than 10 square feet. Vegas has also successfully incentivized the removal of roughly 200 million square feet of turf, saving more than 10% of Nevada's Colorado River allocation. The state is allocated about 1.8% of the river's total water supply. Taken together, the city's water restrictions have freed up room for growth. Over the past 2 decades, Southern Nevada added about 750,000 residents, while reducing Colorado River water consumption by 31%, according to one official. But the need for conservation has become even more pressing. In 2022, Lake Mead and Lake Powell, the two largest reservoirs in the United States, both fed by the Colorado River, were again at record lows. Federal water officials warned that major cutbacks were necessary in some of the states that rely on the Colorado River, Nevada, Arizona, and California. In response, the federal government declared its authority in a worst-case shortage crisis to make sweeping water cuts to cities across the Southwest. Such a scenario was avoided following a wet winter in early 2023, but climate scientists expect the overtapped watershed to provide less and less water in the future. The Phoenix area and other cities are now facing pressure to catch up with Las Vegas as the Southwest becomes even more arid. Phoenix proper gets only about one-third of its water from the Colorado River, but outside its city limits, areas like Scottsdale are more dependent on the river. Scottsdale asked its residents to reduce water use by 5%, stopped homeowner associations from requiring overseeding lawns, and banned the use of grass in front yards for new developments. In an especially dramatic move, Scottsdale cut off water to the Rio Verde foothills, an outlying community of 2,000 homes. The community was built by so-called wildcat developers who avoided official requirements for subdivisions. Arizona's Groundwater Management Act, passed in 1980, requires developers in urban areas to prove that they can meet residents' water needs for the next 100 years. The developers behind Rio Verde foothills took advantage of legal loopholes to sidestep this requirement. So people went ahead and bought homes there, even though Rio Verde foothills lies beyond the reach of Scottsdale's pipe systems, and the groundwater isn't plentiful enough for all residents to access wells. For decades, many of the households in Rio Verde foothills had their water hauled in from Scottsdale's water supply. But in 2022, Scottsdale announced that it would stop supplying that water. "There is no Santa Claus," declared Scottsdale Mayor David Ortega in a statement on December 9, 2022, echoing the kinds of warnings Las Vegas officials have been issuing for years. "The mega drought tells us all. Water is not a compassion game." Scottsdale later agreed to keep supplying water until the end of 2025, though it's bringing in that supply from outside contractors. Eventually, Rio Verde foothills will find its own source of water. Cameron Donna Ruma is a Las Vegas water waste investigator, or water cop, as he usually rolls out in his patrol car at 4 a.m., before residents power up their sprinklers. Each address has a mandated watering time, which changes seasonally and is designed to minimize freezing and evaporation. His job description, laid out in a flashy decal wrapped around the side of the car, is to protect and conserve. Before the sun rises, he gets a first-hand look at the changing landscape of the Las Vegas Valley, where lush green plots have been replaced with rocks, succulents, flowering bushes, and long, scrubby desert grasses. In 2021, the Nevada legislature required the removal of sidewalk and median turf by 2026. Yard signs mark patches of dry grass along sidewalks, curbs, and artificial lakes. This turf removal is mandated by State Law AB 356, the signs tell residents. Once an emerald patchwork in the desert, the grass is no longer watered. It's on its way out, as are hundreds more acres of turf across the Las Vegas Valley, which gets about 4 inches of rain each year. In a recent ride-along, Donna Ruma flared bright amber strobe lights as he drove his car into a community in northwest Las Vegas. It was not long before he spotted a sprinkler run afoul. The violation was the most common issue he sees, water leaving the property and running into the street. Since it was the household's first offense, it got off with a warning. Another violation will come with an $80 fine, doubling from there. But speaking with a customer face-to-face is even better. "We're not here to be scary and to be bullies," he says. "We're here to educate customers." Not everybody appreciates the lesson. One citizens group, the Water Fairness Coalition, has appeared at recent county meetings to question for whom they are making sacrifices. Why should they forego water to make room for growth? What about the farmers who use about 80% of the Colorado River, compared with the sliver Las Vegas gets? And what will happen to the old-growth trees? Norm Schilling, a local landscaper and co-host of the show Desert Bloom on Las Vegas's NPR affiliate, sees this tension encapsulated in an old walnut tree. Standing in the front yard of one of his customers' homes in McNeil Estates, where older homes have lush landscapes, he points to a walnut tree flanked by grass. Schilling says its roots still need grass to survive. He worries that new excessive use fees could force residents to rip up healthy, shady trees and replace them with smaller, less mature trees, albeit more drought-resistant ones. Schilling wants the Water Authority to slow down, preserve existing trees, adjust fees more gradually, and phase in change. Let us nurture the urban forests that we have, he says, and let us have a very thoughtful, timely transition. Las Vegas water officials insist that their conservation plan is sound. To tree lovers like Schilling, they say that there are ways to keep trees alive without thirsty lawns and sprinkler systems. For instance, applying water directly to the tree's roots using a soil probe. They also say the rate structure for water usage fees is fair, noting that the top 10% of residential users consume most of the water. The thresholds for single-family homes change each season, ranging from 14,000 gallons in winter to 28,000 gallons in summer, and residents have to pay $9 for every 1,000 gallons they go over the limit. Last year, a water official said he couldn't imagine that people would argue that their landscaping matters more than their neighbors do if deep Colorado River cuts come. From the sky, golf courses appear as a conspicuous exception, but even they have trimmed back. Golf courses in Vegas have a limited water budget, and that budget is tightening this year. Country clubs have been forced to pull out non-functional turf and make other big changes. Anthem Country Club, about 15 miles from the Las Vegas Strip, traded its original rye grass, which stays greener at cold temperatures, for Bermuda grass, which turns browner in the winter but requires less water. The city is also paying close attention to commercial newcomers, making sure they'll be amenable to conservation. Recently, officials unveiled a tool to rank the expected water use of companies eyeing Las Vegas. The tool produces an overall water score that is then balanced with other factors like job creation and average salary. But that kind of strategic thinking isn't the biggest challenge officials say they face. I know it sounds simplistic to say, making people change their behavior is the hardest part, says Ensminger, sitting in an executive office that overlooks the Las Vegas Valley. But that's always the hardest part. Every group we talk to says, we fully support your conservation programs, but how do we get a carve-out for our little piece? His response, there's no silver bullet. This is a silver buckshot. Every single pellet is needed. That completes the first article. The author, Daniel Rothberg, is a Nevada-based environmental reporter covering water, public land, energy, and mining. And the name of his article was Las Vegas Bets on the Future. And if you've joined late, this is the Smithsonian Magazine program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. I'm reading from the April-May 2024 issue of the Smithsonian. Our second article today is titled A Stitch in Time. How do filmmakers get period clothing to look the part? Inside the workshop where Rabbit Goody brings the past to life. By Rachel Dickinson. Even before you walk into the prefabricated steel building set in the woods off a country road, You'll hear a muffled clacking sound. Once you step through the door into the workroom of Thistle Hill Weavers outside of Cherry Valley, New York, the noise from the electric-powered mechanized looms grows almost deafening. A peek inside the room shows workers wisely wearing ear protectors. Labeled archival boxes crammed on floor-to-ceiling shelves almost fill the workroom, leaving just enough space for several wooden floor looms. A large wooden work table fills the rest of the space, where a weaver might sit and attach trim or fringe to the edge of a piece of fabric, or closely examine something right off a loom, or where, at noon, you would find the weavers eating their lunches. The mill's owner, Susan Rabbit Goody, 72, short and slight, in baggy trousers and a brown knit sweater, her hair in a reddish-gray braid, stands next to the weaver sitting at one of the floor looms, watching as she weaves a sample. The weaver is nervous. She knows the boss is exacting and will accept no irregularities. "Clients want our fabric because it's incredibly custom," Goody says. Thistle Hill Weavers, founded by Rabbit Goody in 1989, makes textiles for movies and television shows, historic houses, and high-end furniture and clothing companies. What sets this little mill in central New York apart from every other cloth manufacturer in the country is Goody's remarkable ability to reanimate the past. No one else produces short runs of textiles that so faithfully replicate the weave, texture, weight, and color of historic fabrics. If you've seen The Gilded Age or Cinderella Man, you've seen Goody's work in action. The majority of Thistle Hill's income comes from creating more contemporary fabrics for interior designers and architects, and from the work Goody does with historic houses, such as Mount Vernon, George Washington's home in Virginia. Yet many of her favorite jobs have come from Hollywood costume designers seeking perfectly rendered, historically accurate textiles to recreate items like Abraham Lincoln's shawl for the movie Lincoln, or much of the colonial-era clothing seen in the 2008 miniseries John Adams. Goody was born in 1951, the middle child among three girls, and raised in suburban New Jersey. When Susan was small, her father referred to her as Hasenpfeffer, a term of endearment that means rabbit stew in German. The rabbit part stuck. She began weaving in her teen years because she was fascinated with the process. After graduating with a degree in cultural anthropology and ethnomusicology from Bennington College in Vermont, in 1972 she headed with friends to the rural Cherry Valley region of New York, where she made money by working as a milker on dairy farms. She bought a 150-acre former farmstead in 1975 and lived there with her first husband in a tiny cabin for 5 years, while they built a three-story home patterned after a 1690 Connecticut house. Goody has made money from her weaving since she was a teenager. She hand-wove cashmere and silk men's scarves and sold them at large craft fairs and trade shows, and later supplied them directly to New York stores like Saks Fifth Avenue. Later, as head of the domestic arts program and curator of textiles at the Farmers Museum in Cooperstown, Goody became a recognized expert in early American textiles and their production. She also founded the Textile History Forum, which holds an annual conference of researchers, museum professionals, and scholars. In 1989, Goody bought an old feed mill near the village of Cherry Valley, where she set up her first mechanized power looms and hired two workers. Their first big job entailed creating denim cloth for Confederate Civil War reenactors. Within 2 years, Goody had moved her growing operation to a new structure beside her house and horse farm that could hold all the machinery on one floor. Today, Thistle Hill Weavers employs 7 people, whom Goody has trained to run the 9 mechanized shuttle looms dating from the 1890s through the 1960s, plus archaic-sounding equipment like a warp winder and a quiller, all necessary to transform big cones of thread into beautiful pieces of fabric. Goody's workers generally arrive with no knowledge of weaving. She teaches them everything they need to know. Over a couple of decades, Goody has traveled from Virginia to New Jersey to scrounge machinery. When she'd hear of a textile mill closing, she'd get on the phone and offer to haul the looms away until she had filled her own operation with equipment once destined for the scrap heap. She has a fondness for mechanized looms made by the legendary industrial loom maker Crompton and Knowles from the early to mid-20th century, which she's taught herself how to fix and keep running. Over the past 25 years, Thistle Hill's fabric has been sewn into clothing for films as varied as Peter Weir's Master and Commander, the Coen Brothers' No Country for Old Men, and Darren Aronofsky's Noah, as well as series such as John Adams and Turn, Washington Spies. Occasionally, Goody even hand-weaves a piece herself, like the replica of a large fragment of the original Star-Spangled Banner, which she created for a 2019 performance by the magician David Copperfield at the Smithsonian. When a costume designer approaches Thistle Hill, Goody gathers details about the kind of fabric they want and exactly what it will be used for. Then Goody uses 21st century technology to translate the client's ideas into reality. She sits at a small loom attached to a computer, which she can program to create various weave patterns. She chooses threads that would work best in terms of weight, texture, and color, then creates samples, small strips of woven fabric that can be produced in a matter of minutes. Goody overnights the samples to clients. Designers love these swatches and the multiplicity of weaves to choose from. Goody's designs are painstaking, nearly down to the microscopic level. Just changing a yarn weight or color can completely change the fabric, says Patrick Wiley, a costume designer who's worked on several projects with Goody, including the movies Winter's Tale and The Pale Blue Eye. Designers like Wiley know that something as simple as the weight of a fabric in a shirt or a coat can make an actor move differently, and that this difference brings an ineffable authenticity to a given period film. Take Tom Hanks's overcoat in Road to Perdition, a 2002 film set in the 1930s. The fabric Goody produced had the look and heft of period material, but when the coat got wet, it weighed a full 32 pounds, and Hanks couldn't walk while wearing it. "We had to weave more fabric than looked exactly the same," Goody says, "but used much lighter material for the coat used in the rain scenes." As a respected historian of American textiles, Goody brings an authority to her film projects. She is utterly brilliant in her skills of weaving and is also immensely knowledgeable in her history, says costume designer Joanna Johnston, who worked with Goody on Steven Spielberg's Lincoln and Robert Zemeckis' Here, an upcoming 2024 release in which the narration toggles wildly between the past and the future. Goody wove the shawl for Daniel Day-Lewis to wear as Lincoln, based on a careful study of the original dark wool shawl now held by the Smithsonian. When the film came out in theaters, Goody took the Weavers to a matinee so they could experience the thrill of seeing their work on the big screen. Back at the mill, when you walk into the room when the mechanized looms are running, you'll yearn for the ear protectors the Weavers wear. On one loom are yards of delicate white dimity, a lightweight cotton fabric for the curtains in Emily's bedroom in the Emily Dickinson House in Amherst, Massachusetts. A brightly striped Venetian carpet is taking shape on another loom. One worker is weaving fabric from spun threads of natural brown cotton, an unusual heirloom variety, first grown by descendants of French settlers, for the very farmer who grew the cotton. He'll sell it in his country store. And on the warp winder, a huge wooden wheel, a full 8 feet in diameter, are multicolor and glittery threads wrapped around a beam, ready to be transferred to a loom, where a worker will weave them into a fabric for a Mandalorian cloak. Though much of Goody's work is historic reproduction, some textiles are used for science fiction and even cosplay. Goody stops to peer closely at each piece. And with that, we have run out of time today. The title of this article was A Stitch in Time by Rachel Dickinson. This has been the Smithsonian Magazine program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. It's been my privilege to be your reader today. I hope you enjoyed the program. The articles are from the April-May 2024 edition of the Smithsonian Magazine. Stay well, stay safe, have a wonderful week, and keep listening to the premium programming offered by Sun Sounds of Arizona. And if you missed a program you'd like to hear, go to the sunsounds.org website, click on the broadcast info and audio, and then click on demand. You'll see a list of programs available to you. Hopefully you'll find the one you're looking for. Thank you so much for spending your time with me today.